Let's go back on the record. So it's my understanding that we're gonna try to finish up by 5:30 today. If not, I see a long continuance, nothing in the next, let's say nothing in 2021. So let's give public staff plenty of time for rebuttal or reply. And go ahead and get started, Mr. Soden.
Okay, Mr. Metz, I will make a deal with you. I'm gonna try to get us out here as quickly as I can. I am going to try to avoid having to refer to documents. If you could help me with that, that'd be super great. Okay, so Mr. Metz, are you aware that Duke has taken up the position in the IRP that achieving the carbon reduction targets of around 70% will require very substantial investments in the transmission grid?
In the 2020 IRP, there were general assumptions in the IRP process that made some assumptions on a 70% target with generic portfolios, but maybe not the cost optimal portfolios.
Okay, understood that those were not highly granular transmission estimates, but that would you agree that at those very, very high level estimates, Duke was estimating on the order of $4+ billion for the 70% carbon reduction scenarios?
Subject check, yes.
Okay, thank you. So the public staff takes the position that investments in the transmission system should be evaluated through a comprehensive system planning process. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And you provided testimony to that effect in the Frisian CPCN docket. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And you provided that testimony in December 2019 or thereabouts?
So did you check.
When you provided that testimony in 2019, was there a comprehensive transmission planning process in North Carolina?
Well, the current utilities have their transmission planning, and then through the North Carolina Transmission Planning Collaborative that they look at, in my words, sort of immediate issues or imminent issues, and as well as potential policy changes or factors or functions that could increase efficiency through joint utility operation.
But the North Carolina Transmission Planning Collaborative is not a comprehensive transmission planning process of the kind you described in your testimony in Frisian, is it?
No, it would be a function to inform the process that I was specifying in testimony.
Okay, and as I think was testified to earlier, there was a colloquy between Mr. Levitis and Commissioner Clodfelter that for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, the collaborative looks at transmission work that's required to maintain reliability, right?
That is one function, and then there's two scenarios that can be submitted. I can't remember what the other one of them is, but the other is the policy. And the policy one is one which even the public staff initiated a public policy request on a portfolio similar to the 2020 IRP, sort of a all of the above approach, simplified, to evaluate the total transmission investment requirements needed across both utilities.
Okay, thank you. As you sit here today, there is not in existence a comprehensive transmission planning process for North Carolina, is there?
The existing process that Duke Energy, as the transmission owner per NERC guidance and overseen by CERC, does evaluate long-term planning, maybe the nuance there, but there are processes in place which the utility does evaluate the transmission system. I can't specify that necessarily. Is that a 5-year horizon, 10-year horizon, or 40-year horizon?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go back to what you previously testified to, and that's that investments in the transmission system should be evaluated through a comprehensive system planning process.
I agree.
Okay. So is there a comprehensive system planning process that globally looks at necessary investments in the transmission system?
As of today, it is not my understanding that when we're looking at an IRP over the generation assets over the next 40 years, there is not a all-inclusive planning collaborative.
Okay, and is North Carolina in the process of developing a comprehensive transmission planning process?
I believe the initiative or the policy request through the TAG or NCPTC is a step in that direction to help inform the Clean Power Plan.
Okay, but do you have any idea when such a process might be established?
No, I do not.
Okay, thank you. And is it the public staff's position that significant investments in the grid should await the advent of a comprehensive transmission planning process?
They don't necessarily have to be precluded.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Metz, the commission frequently grants CPCNs that have conditions, doesn't it?
Yes, public staff has even requested some conditions in some cases.
Do you think it's important for the conditions in a CPCN to have a clearly understandable meaning?
Yes.
Okay. And so you just mentioned a moment ago that the public staff frequently recommends the granting of CPCNs with conditions, is that right?
That is correct, and as we go through some of those processes, they can be very challenging at times to try to think of every what if or iteration or possibility that may exist, but yes.
Okay, thank you. With regard to upgrade costs, what sort of conditions has the public staff recommended that the commission include in CPCNs?
I can't recite them off the top of my head. I believe there were some conditions in the most recent, when I say the most recent, with over the last year or 18 months on some of the EMP applications, given the fluid nature of the affected systems and the cost responsibility of certain merchant plants. Again, as we discussed earlier, that process is before appeal at the FERC.
Okay. Would you agree that, sort of just at a high level, what those conditions have said is that if an applicant or a CPCN holder sees a significant increase in their upgrade costs, they need to report that back to the commission. Is that right?
Yes.
And the commission may reopen the CPCN if there is a significant change in cost. Is that right?
Yes.
But none of those conditions that have been imposed define what a significant increase in costs is, do they?
No, they do not. And that's part of the challenges. Mm-hmm.
So those conditions provide very little certainty to a certificate holder as to whether its CPCN might be revoked. Is that right? Might be revoked in the event of a change in upgrade costs.
That is correct.
Okay, so even if an applicant or a CPCN holder knows exactly what its upgrade costs are, it still doesn't really know or have any way of knowing whether the commission will revoke its CPCN, does it?
It's a possibility if circumstances change that the CPCN could be revoked for multiple factors, inclusive of cost, most of which would require speculation on my part for what would trigger the revocation.
Mm-hmm. Juno Solar's proposed condition also allows the CPCN to be revisited once upgrade costs are known, doesn't it?
Say it again, please.
The condition that Juno Solar has proposed for its CPCN would also allow its CPCN to be revisited once upgrade costs are known with more specificity, doesn't it?
That is one provision with the inclusion that the wanted determination provision at the execution of the IA.
Okay. Isn't the only difference between this proposed condition and the proposed condition that the conditions that the public staff has previously recommended that Juno's proposed condition provides specific guidance to the applicant as to the conditions under which its CPCN will be revoked?
I don't agree with that generalization. There are multiple factors unique in some of the specific EMP applications, and it would take some time to go down the specifics and go through over the, in some cases, almost a year of the fluid nature of some of the conversation, discoveries, and testimony on multiple EMP dockets.
Well, the conditions that the public staff has recommended in those other dockets all look pretty similar, don't they?
Similar in some, with one of the concept being evaluating the affected system attributes, which that was based upon a snapshot in time, as we've learned and as I filed testimony for this commission, that has proven to be extremely problematic and challenging and changing.
So I just asked you a moment ago if you agreed whether Gino's proposed condition is just a variation on the condition that the commission, I'm sorry, that the public staff has already recommended with just additional specificity. And you disagreed with that, right?
General disagreements can make the variations open-ended. I mean, anything with a minute change is a variation, but not to be talking in circles. But.
Okay. The public staff objects to the condition that's proposed by Gino here. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And you discussed the public staff's objections in your direct testimony, don't you?
Yes, we believe until a completed facility study by the incumbent utility is completed, that we cannot provide a recommendation to the commission.
Okay. So I'd like you to please look at page 34 of your testimony, starting on line 5.
Page 34, line 5.
34, yes, starting on line 5. Sorry, I think I have the wrong. I apologize. I have the wrong page. Sorry, if you give me just a moment, I'm close to it. Okay, I'm sorry. It's page 33. Line 5.
Page 33, line 5.
Okay. Okay. We're starting a little before that. You say that the applicant's requested condition presents other problems. And then you say that the upcoming TCS will be the first of its kind for generating facilities in the Duke balancing areas. And the public staff is concerned that if the costs go over the predetermined conditional threshold, withdrawals and delays may occur while the commission rehears the CPC and application at the request of the applicant. Did I read that correctly?
That is correct. And for context, that was based upon a snapshot in time of which the applicant wanted the ability to, not putting words in the applicant's mouth, but challenge if it went over the $4 LCOT in part.
Okay. But this concern has been addressed by Juno's agreement that its CPCN will simply terminate if the LCOT goes over $400. I'm sorry, over $4. Is that right?
In part, especially to the withdrawals that may occur while the commission rehears the CPC and applications, yes.
Okay, so withdrawal of these delays would not occur if the CPC were simply terminated and there was no rehearing?
I'm having a hard time following you on that one.
Okay, well you say here that withdrawals and delays may occur while the commission rehears the CPC and application at the request of the applicant, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that's not going to happen if the CPCN just terminates, right?
Because the applicant would not be back before the commission, yes.
Okay, thank you. And then, further down the page, starting on line 12, you say that the public staff believes that the applicant is shifting risk from itself unjustly onto captive ratepayers based on a metric that can be greatly changed if the facility changes design or reduces its nameplate capacity prior to commercial operation or over the life of the project. Did I read that correctly?
Correct.
Okay, so what you're saying here is that there's a risk that the LCOT of the project could change later, even after the IA is issued, if the facility were to add a battery or reduce its nameplate capacity?
Correct.
Okay. But the facility would have to amend its CPCN to change its design, wouldn't it?
It would have to change to amend its design. And this is where it gets into the nuances of the provisions. But if for the applicant's request, a determination provision is at the execution of the IA, the applicant can, after the IA, perform an amendment for any situation, which I specified in testimony, some may even be outside of your control and may even be reasonable, but it would impact the overall LCOT calculation or the magnitude or any function thereof.
But if Juno were to change its design, and it would have to notify the commission of this in a way that reduces LCOT, the commission would be free to take action based on that, wouldn't it?
The commission may exercise its discretion as it wants.
Okay. So this would, the commission's ability to take action based on, well, let me rephrase that. It would seem that Juno's obligation to notify the commission of a change in facility design and the commission's ability, which we all agree to take action based on that, should resolve any concern that you've expressed right here, wouldn't it?
No, because I think I just specified before, if the contract, or if a provision is that the revocable provision terminates after the IA, changes may occur after the IA, which still impact either the magnitude LOC, LCOT, or the potential upgrades. So that's what I was saying. As you start going down these conditions, there's multiple iterations of which you have to consider in respect of the timeline and as they move through the TCS process as the applicant has requested in this. Conditions are challenging. They can be implemented, but they have pitfalls.
But Juno has an obligation to notify the commission of a change to its design independent of any condition in the CPC, doesn't it?
That is correct.
And don't the rules provide that the commission, upon receiving notice of a change in a facility, has the discretion to take such proceedings as it deems appropriate?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Metz, I want to talk just for a few minutes about FERC's crediting policy. Do you know what I'm referring to when I say that?
Generally familiar, yes.
Okay. Is it fair to say that the public staff does not agree with the crediting policy and believes it should be abrogated?
Say that again, please.
Is it fair to say that the public staff believes that FERC's crediting policy is inappropriate?
I think that requires a legal conclusion as technical evaluation. I'm not weighing into FERC's crediting policy.
I can just offer that, you know, we have comments in the ANOPR docket that speak for themselves. That's sufficient to the commission.
Okay. I want to talk about it a little bit, I guess. Well, Mr. Metz, are you familiar with the comments that the public staff has filed in FERC's ANOPR proceeding?
I did not have them memorized. I am generally familiar that the public staff filed comments and reply comments.
Okay, and when we say the ANOPR proceeding, that is the advance notice of proposed rulemaking on transmission policy, I forget the full name, that is underway right now at FERC, right?
That is correct.
Okay, and are you aware that in the public staff's comments on the ANOPR, the public staff recommended that FERC do away with the crediting policy?
The public staff comments speak for themselves. If that's what they say, that's what they say.
Okay.
I would just offer that Mr. Metz did not participate very fully in the ANOPR docket.
Okay, so Mr. Metz, you did not participate in developing the public staff's comments on the ANOPR?
That is correct.
Well, let me ask you this. To what extent is the possible application of the crediting policy driving the public staff's position on Juno's CPC and application?
I don't believe my testimony rejected the application or directly took discriminatory function towards the crediting policy. The FERC crediting policy is the FERC crediting policy.
Understood. But the public staff expresses concerns about the possibility that Juno will incur upgrades that will be repaid by, in part, by Duke's ratepayers, right?
That is a function of the crediting policy, yes.
Okay, and that potential for repayment is an issue that you raise in your testimony, is it not?
Not the repayment mechanism in itself, but the nature of the upgrades and whether or not the DEP system needs those upgrades.
I'm going to object to this line of questioning. I think Mr. Metz testifies about impact ratepayers of the reimbursement policy, but does not go into the merits of the policy itself.
Mr. Snowden?
Yes, ma'am.
Move on.
Okay, thank you. All right. All right, well, I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Metz. Commissioner Duffley, I would move that our Juno cross-examination exhibits, let's see, we have one and two be moved into evidence.
Any objection?
No.
Without objection, that motion is allowed.
Thank you.
Redirect.
Mr. Metz, I'll try to be quick. You participated fully in the Q Reform stakeholder process. Is that correct?
Yes.
Would you say it's an accurate to say that the public staff largely took a backseat role in terms of any comments on milestones, penalties, timelines?
That is correct.
That it mostly left those discussions to the developers?
Yes, developers were having multiple conversations. As the public staff has to be, at least I'm cognizant when I go into certain stakeholder groups, is that when the public staff speaks, sometimes it can have a chilling effect on the group because we don't necessarily come across as a stakeholder, but we're coming across as, in order for this to pass, this is what has to be incorporated. So we try to work through that. We work through that the best we can, but that was something in consideration explicitly in the Q Reform process.
And largely the timelines affected the utility and interconnection customers and not so much the public staff's interests.
That is correct. Those were mutually agreed upon timelines between the stakeholders and the utility planners to perform studies. Stakeholders have enough time to make their decisions and to complete it within the windows that were agreed upon.
And to your knowledge, both the FERC filing and the North Carolina Interconnection Procedures Q Reform filing by Duke make a commitment to report in 2 years after the transitional study cluster and after the first ICES round on lessons learned and potential changes to both the LGIP and the NCIP.
That is correct. As with any new policy that gets any new initiation like this takes place, there will be lessons learned. There could be improvements. There could be even the potential of improved efficiencies leveraged as we gain more knowledge.
These timelines aren't set in stone, basically.
The timelines aren't set in stone and can be modified in future cases.
And do you recall the public staff's interconnection comments on Duke's Q Reform filing reply comments submitted 831 that provided, you know, that the public staff was concerned about the alignment of affected system studies?
Yes, the public staff brought that forward to the stakeholders and to the commission. And in my opinion, is just the larger stakeholder group did not want to further advance that potential concern. It could be for numerous reasons, but it's required too much speculation on my part. However, that would be a FERC-governed process through the affected systems and not NCIP. Other than NCIP has to reference to when the affected system is triggered, you need to go follow that procedure.
Presiding Commissioner Duffley, I would ask at this time that the Commission take judicial notice of the public staff's reply comments filed on August 31st, 2020 in the interconnection docket E100 sub 101.
Without objection, we will take judicial notice.
Thank you. I wanted to clarify one quick question that you answered. You, in response to a question, you said that there were two FERC jurisdictional projects in the transition cluster in DEP.
That is correct. Those are two solar projects within DEP and FERC in North Carolina.
There are three other FERC battery projects, and that can be seen in this. This is previously today marked as public staff Miller Cross Exhibit number one.
Yes, that is correct.
On page nine. You were asked earlier by Mr. Snowden, you know, how are interconnection customers supposed to proceed forward when they have, you know, essentially no guidance about what the commission will consider an appropriate LCOT or an appropriate magnitude of cost? Would you agree that the Friesian final order and discussion of the LBNL provided certain benchmarks that could be relied upon going forward?
Absolutely, I agree.
Back to the start of questioning, you were asked about the demonstration of need and when the public staff says the demonstration of need has been met, you know, maybe has had some various, you know, different, you know, evolving iterations. Would you agree generally though that the demonstration of need needs to be balanced with costs and any other potential adverse impacts to ratepayers?
That is correct.
And would you say that it is appropriate to have a, you know, a higher standard, a higher demonstration of need when adverse impacts to ratepayers are likely?
That is correct, because we need the ability to evaluate those adverse impacts to ratepayers.
As my colleague has any other redirect questions.
Yes, just a few. Mr. Metz, do you remember when Mr. Snowden was asking you about the Timber Mill Wind project and if the and that the public staff found a need for the facility in EMP 118?
I remember the line of question, yes.
Yeah. I'd move to introduce the testimony, the confidential testimony of Jeff Thomas in EMP 118 sub-zero into the record as public staff, Metz redirect confidential exhibit one. I will not have to touch on any confidential information, but.
Any objection?
I would only just note that we don't have a confidentiality agreement with other parties in that litigation. So if that's, we are able to see the confidential exhibit in its entirety due to, you know, in this proceeding, that's fine. If we're not able to review it, I think we would have checked.
I can just take judicial notice of his testimony, of Mr. Thomas's testimony in this proceeding, and ask Mr. Metz the questions.
Do you have objections?
We would also object to taking judicial notice of a confidential filing that we do not have the ability to review. Is there a redacted version?
Yes, there is a redacted version on the in the file.
Okay. Is it possible to get a redacted version for us to review?
Excuse me?
Is it possible to get a redacted copy?
Yes, I can. I mean, I don't have one with me at this moment.
Mr. Josie, do you want to take judicial notice of the redacted portion?
Yes.
Any objection?
No objection.
So allowed.
Mr. Metz, do you have a copy of the testimony of Mr. Thomas in EMP 118 sub-zero?
I do.
Okay. And on page 9 of Mr. Thomas's testimony, the question starting on line 10, why is the facility needed? Do you see that?
I see it.
Yes, and the answer is, according to Timber Mill Wind, the facility is needed because of the North Carolina Renewable Energy. He goes on to discuss why Timber Mill states that the facility is needed, not that the public staff found that there was need.
That is correct.
And on page 17, lines 3 and 4, Mr. Thomas does recommend approval of this facility, correct?
Yes.
And on page 12, line 9, Mr. Thomas states that Timber Mill Wind is solely responsible for 100% of the network upgrades, correct?
Page 9?
Yes, page 9.
That is correct.
Excuse me, that's page 12, line 9. Sorry about that. And then also on line 12 of page 9, Mr. Thomas states that as recently as February 26, 2021, PJM confirmed that Timber Mill Wind does not rely on any affected systems cost, correct?
You're losing me on the page numbers, but
so page 12, lines 12 through 14. That is correct. And as you just discussed with Ms. Cummings, when there are no costs borne by ratepayers to construct the facility, the analysis of the CPCN application and the need of the facility and the associated benefits require a different analysis than we are looking at in this proceeding here, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And just one final line of questioning. On page 11, Mr. Thomas states that Timber Mill finalized its facility study in September of 2015. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And on page 3, does Mr. Thomas state that Timber Mill filed its CPCN application on June 14th, 2021?
That would be after the complete facility study, yes.
Yes, almost 6 years after, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
No further questions.
Commissioner, questions?
All right, Mr. Mass, just a few for you. The two FERC jurisdictional projects that are identified in the transitional cluster report, you have that in front of you?
I do not.
I just.
I have it in front of me.
Okay. I'm looking at page 9 just to get you there quickly, but. So one of those projects obviously is Juno. What's the other project? What can you tell me about the other project?
You're referencing the 69.9 megawatt project?
Yes.
That's, I believe that was discussed earlier, that's Frisian.
That is Frisian. And so in this project, what we're hearing, make sure I understand this correctly, we're hearing from the developer that it needs the CPCN to move forward, it needs the certainty of the CPCN to move forward with the various phases of the interconnection process it's now in. Have we heard anything, has the public staff heard anything on the Frisian project that's similar, a similar argument from the Frisian project?
I have not.
Okay. Are you aware of whether an entity associated with Frisian has made a filing similar to the filing made in this docket?
I'll only look over to council. They might be involved in more conversations
today,
but I am not cognizant.
You're not aware. Okay, that's all I need to know. What line is it, to the extent that you know, Mr. Mass, what line has to be upgraded for the Juno project?
That information was not provided. We asked for that in discovery. There became a question of whether or not we could evaluate critical energy infrastructure and whether or not we had the clearance, given the timeline that we did not pursue that any further. Only thing I can add is that we see facility upgrades publicly through the PJM facility study and system impact study that have nothing to do per se with CEII.
But given all of that, you don't know what line has to be upgraded here?
I do not.
Okay. Is it possible that it was the same line that was involved in the Frisian interconnection?
I do not know.
Okay.
I mean, it is a possibility that it's not. These are just whether it is in the southeast North Carolina, which involves many counties, given the topology of the transmission system, they are somewhat isolated from one another. We did have in discovery a Q&A that we asked from the applicant on the Frisian upgrades. I can find that if you want, or we can bring that to your attention in a late filed exhibit that asked the exact question about Frisian.
I would like that as a late file exhibit, the applicant's response to the data request. Help me, we've heard a lot today in testimony from the applicant about the consequences of upgrading this portion of the DEP transmission system. As it relates to requirements now set out in state law, et cetera. You've kind of been here the whole time, you've heard it. What, Mr. Metz, just help me understand sort of the engineering of all of this. So how does upgrading the line associated with this one facility unlock, or sort of create a solution to a catch-22?
Without taking the argument of catch-22,
understood.
When we look at generation needs, available capacity, or room on the transmission system. So let's just simplify and say, larger the wire, the more electricity that I can move through. Simplifying assumptions. That if load increases, it creates heat, and therefore I have to upsize the transmission line, yada, yada, yada. I need more generation, so generation is solving for load. And to the extent that you have excess generation, you need to reconfigure, in some cases, you need to reconfigure the electrical system to allow that excess generation to get to the parts of the system, so that way you don't have excess voltage or decrease or increase in voltage or increase and decrease in frequency, because the system has to balance. So when you're evaluating those configurations in the system at that given point in time, sometimes multiple projects can be impacting a single line. Sometimes it can be a sole project. It is based upon the configuration and sort of the resistances and impedances of the system at that snapshot.
Okay. So if there's a line associated with Juno that's upgraded, how does that single upgrade, or how do the upgrades associated with the project facilitate the interconnection of other projects? Does it necessarily mean that those projects are going to have to interconnect to the same line, or it's just fewer upgrades on the system in general that the next project has to conduct?
It's very complicated in nature. It's always, you sort of get to that tipping point. So we never want to build out the system in too much excess, so we continue to add in incremental amounts. It could be just under the unique circumstances of that change case or load case in transmission planning that it was just enough energy in that unique configuration. So like, say, hypothetically, two projects never triggered it, but three projects did. Well, through the TCS process, we'll assign the cost accordingly. But it's not to say that this project is going to be this, again, that they're, I don't know the nature of the upgrades, so I don't want to speculate too much. It's unknown of how this would magically unlock the southeast part of the system. I have one project that's triggering, by the applicant studies, $13 million to $16 million studies over here in this part of the state, but I have another project that's a fraction of the size of Juno that triggered 200 million, whatever the final number was. It's hard to correlate those. And to me, it just doesn't make much sense that this sole 275 megawatt project is gonna be the silver bullet to unlock all the upgrades.
Okay, I got two more questions for you. First one, I'm gonna ask you to speculate. What does the inclusion of the battery in this facility do to upgrades that would have to be made on the system?
So with the assumption that the battery is DC connected, and therefore I don't have to look at it as a load, I'm not charging the battery off the AC line, under that assumption, is that typically when you look at energy output of a solar facility, you look at it as a generation profile. I forget the exact hours, let's just call it 9 to 9, sunrise, sunset, little caveats in the timeline. But then you look at its the transmission load portfolio, the coincident load over those timings. So where the battery starts introducing a unique caveat is saying, well, if the battery can discharge at any point in time, because it's a merchant power generator, how does Duke Energy Progress, the transmission owner, need to evaluate that injection onto the system? Because you have to, as we've had comments before the commission, you need to evaluate the ramp of discharge and as well as the amplitude. And so the utility would need to evaluate those during different periods than just the summer profile.
Okay. All right, last question for you. We've talked a lot about the ELCOT today. This is a, as proposed, 275 megawatts solar generating facility. I assume that, and you can tell me if I'm sort of
thinking about this incorrectly, but the facility really can be downsized at any point in time prior to construction occurring. Is that a correct assumption? Like, you could, the facility could be studied as 275, certificated as 275, but then could be constructed at a lower nameplate, a smaller nameplate capacity, a lesser nameplate capacity. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Does that happen frequently?
Well, based upon SP applications, I would say yes, but I don't have that quantified as a percentage of change.
And that's fair, but just in your experience, that does happen.
Yes, it does happen. Sometimes it's actually to the benefit. If a facility was triggering upgrades, they could actually reduce it and say, oh, 223, again, hypothetical, is the magic number. Go to 223. Other times you can get into an operating agreement to say, well, we're having challenges on the system on July between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m., again, being somewhat facetious. You downrate for that given hour when we call upon you to go down to 100 megawatts and not 275. That'll save you $50 million in upgrade costs if you agree to that in operating agreement. Those great I wouldn't say challenges, but operating agreements are another provision that could be utilized in the event once potential impacts or triggers are known.
Are you aware of whether there are any operating agreements in existence as of today between either of the Dukes and a third-party generator?
I've only had conversations and concept of operating agreements that can exist. There's one unique operating agreement with Dominion and PJM under certain configurations of the transmission system for the Greensville combined cycle plant, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay, but with respect to third-party solar, QF solar, you're not aware of an operating agreement?
That is correct.
Okay. All right, that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Matz. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I have one question as a follow-up, and then I'll turn it to
you. Mr. Matz, just one follow-up on this operating agreement. Would you need to go through the facility study process to be able to determine the proper operating agreement? Oh, what point in the process?
I don't have an exact answer that. To be fair, I don't know when that could be implemented. My assumption from an engineering perspective, I would need to know what the upgrades are, or basically what are the overloads. Once I identify the overloads and the time period of those overloads, I can be able to tell you when you need to curtail, the percentage of curtailment. And that would be an informed decision that the applicant can make to say, well, really, can we curtail or not operate? Is it economical, or is it better? Is it more economical to go ahead and pay for the upgrades? What's the cost benefit on either scenario?
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Clodfelter?
Mr. Metz, we've been told that we need to take into consideration the risk that if we do not grant this conditional CN request, that the transitional cluster study process may possibly implode. When I look at Public Staff Miller Cross-Examination Exhibit 1, I can see that there are six projects that will propose to interconnect at the transmission level that are large enough to require CPCNs in South Carolina. Two of those are FERC jurisdictional projects interconnection, one 165 megawatts and one 150 megawatts. By any remote chance, do you have any information as to whether any of those six projects, especially the two that are FERC jurisdictional, have obtained or have requested CPCNs in South Carolina?
I do not know at this time, Commissioner Clodfelter.
Thank you.
I wanted to follow up with something that you stated with respect to comprehensive transmission planning. Do you not consider the North Carolina Transmission Planning Collaborative a proper vehicle for comprehensive transmission planning?
I do, and I thought I'd try to clarify it, so if I said that incorrectly, that was not meant to come across that way. I believe that certain policy initiatives of which the planning collaborative can evaluate, if structured in such a way, can be a vehicle to inform the overall, either sort of like the transmission process or inform sort of the IRP to how to incorporate the sort of the rate impact or the transition to go to these potential portfolios and do it in a form process versus a post-processing analysis in the IRP.
Okay, thank you for that. And Ms. Miller's testimony indicated the upgrades for the Juno project will be minimal. Could you speak to that issue or that testimony?
The overall application and through discovery, I believe they listed as their identified upgrade costs are $13 million with their assigned cost, or worst case, if they're assigned all cost, is $16.84 million for approximately, I believe it was 17 miles of some type of rebuild. I evaluated that on both in my testimony, sort of the overall LCOT impact, which would be approximately $1.34, give or take. And then also provided with the commission and table two is the rate impact of those lower dollar values.
Okay.
And that's in Mets table two, if you were trying to reference it.
Okay, thank you. And then going to the public staff Miller cross exhibit number one on page nine, in the last column, it says percentage study cost debt. And so how is that determined, if you know?
It is my understanding, I haven't checked the math, but that should be a simple ratio. You take up the sum of the megawatts and just apply their pro rata share. So let's say I had 1,000 megawatts. If 1.08 was their share, the math on the standards, but 108 megawatts. No,
okay.
Less than that. No, that's right. Sorry.
Thank you. Questions on commission questions?
Yes, ma'am, we have just a few. I will start at the end. So, Mr. Metz, this follows on. Chair Mitchell had some questions about the downsizing of the project.
Yes.
Isn't it the case that if a FERC jurisdictional project downsizes by more than 10%, that triggers a material modification under the LGIP?
That is my general understanding.
Okay, and that requires a restudy of the project, doesn't it?
The LGIP, yes, that is my understanding.
Okay. Chair Mitchell also asked you a few questions about the potential upgrades that were identified for Juno in relation to the upgrades, the Frisian upgrades that were discussed in the Frisian proceeding. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Would you agree that there are a lot fewer megawatts in the queue or in the transitional cluster now than there were when the Frisian upgrades were studied?
That's true, but I don't see the correlation of that to the Frisian upgrades.
Okay.
I mean, the Frisian upgrades were the cost causer or the tipping point of the overall system at that point in time.
Understood that they were the first to cause that specific overload, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. But the baseline for Frisian study included a lot of megawatts of projects which may or may not be still in the interconnection process, is that right?
I can't agree to that. No.
Do you disagree with that, or you just have no basis for agreeing or disagreeing?
I have no basis for disagreeing. To agree or disagree is just my general understanding of the base case would not assume that I forget what the numbers are, I'm not going to start spitting out thousands of megawatts, should not have been in the base case. It had to be at that point in time for my general understanding is that at that point in time when the system is studied, it is a future look, but it's not based upon other, specifically to Frisian, it's not speculative SPs that have not interconnected with the utility, but the utility would factor in known upgrades that are taking place for already existing service.
Well, wouldn't you agree that all higher queued interconnection customers would have been considered in the baseline for Frisian when it was studied?
In relation to some, I can't answer that because now I'm trying to draw the correlation between the FERC queue and the state queue, and when Frisian was jumping back and not jumping back and forth, but they originally were a state queue project and then transitioned over to the FERC queue.
Understood. When Duke studies projects in the serial process, it treats, from a study standpoint, it treats FERC jurisdictional and state jurisdictional projects on equal footing, right? They're in a single queue for purposes of study, aren't they?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so would you agree that the baseline, so to speak, for the Frisian interconnection studies would have included every prior queued project, whether it was state or FERC jurisdictional, at that time?
I don't know the answer to that at this point, though.
Okay. And I'm just trying to sort of, what I'm getting at here is understanding why the Juno upgrades are so different from the Frisian upgrades. What I heard you say is that you would neither agree nor disagree with the possibility that a lot of projects falling out of the queue as they went into the transitional cluster might be partially responsible for the different study results for Juno than for Frisian.
That is possible. As we also had in discovery, which I believe has been provided to the commission, is the what was the base case for the Juno application, and the base case was the cluster study at that particular point in time, or the cluster or the FERC queue at that particular point in time. As we already know, is that the transitional serial cluster process that will be studied is actually much different now than the queue was when the applicant evaluated the project. And some of the interrelation relationships that start to occur when you start looking at power flow analysis is the possibility, again under hypotheticals, is that if you put a facility on this line on this part of the system, put a facility on this line on this part of the system, in some unique circumstances the power flows could butt one another and the power could go into different parts of the system. So the moment that you start retiring plants, removing plants, in this example I'm saying sort of like Duke Energy Carolinas and Duke Energy Progress, power flows change. Is this a snapshot in time under those unique facts and circumstances? And I don't know what was evaluated. The only thing I can say is the TCS where we're at right now is a lot different than what we understood in discovery.
Understood. And the TCS, as we look at it right now, is a lot different than what the queue looked like when Frisian was evaluated, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Are you familiar with the interconnection settlement between Duke Energy, various settling developers, that was filed with this commission back in September 2020? Generally familiar with it?
I'm generally familiar. No, for some reason, I think there's multiple settlements.
Okay. Do you recall, Mr. Metz, that there was a provision of that settlement that allowed certain distribution projects to be curtailed during high congestion periods so that they could interconnect in congested areas?
I'm generally familiar with that.
Okay. And do you think that Duke's ability to curtail those projects may have, to some extent, alleviated some of the upgrades that were originally assigned to Frisian?
Unknown. I don't know if in Duke's study if they would actually evaluate or call on those curtailments. It'd be speculation.
Understood. Thank you. You talked just a little bit about the Timber Mill Wind proceeding, and Mr. Josie asked you, you pointed out that the public staff didn't explicitly support Timber Mill Wind's assertion of need. It simply didn't oppose it. Is that correct?
The testimony speaks for itself.
Okay. But the public staff did support approval of Timber Mill Wind's application, did it not?
That's correct.
Okay. And it would have only have done so if it agreed that Timber Mill Wind had met the statutory standard for getting a CPC in, right?
It's an elastic standard given the unique facts and circumstances of the specific case at that time. The public staff viewed the circumstances for Timber Mill warranted approval of the CPCN.
Okay. But at least implicitly, the public staff supported Timber Mill Wind's assertion that there was a need for the project. Is that right?
I don't know. I can say that's implicitly the public staff supported the approval of the application.
Okay. You also testified in response to Mr. Josie's question that where there are...
Excuse excuse me. Sorry. Keep in mind, these are questions on commission
questions.
I'm
sorry. I apologize. Yeah. This was recross. So those are all my questions. Thank you.
Just one question in response to Chair Mitchell's questions about downsizing. Do you have a copy of Public Staff Leviticus Cross Exhibit Number 1, which is the large generator interconnection procedures?
It may not be marked. I have a pile of stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
On the definition section on page 6, there's a definition of material modification. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
And it states that in regard to the definitive interconnection study process, as opposed to a serial process, that modifications that have a material impact on the cost or timing of any interconnection request with a later queue position or a queue position which is included in the same cluster. So it has to, a material modification has to impact another project. Do you agree with that?
I would agree, yes.
And if you turn to page 32, this is the bottom of page 32, section 5.4.1.
Under.
There's specific provisions regarding material modifications prior to system impact study. That includes a decrease of up to 60% in the electrical output of the facility.
Yes, with, as you noted, with prior to system impact study agreement.
Right. And 5.4.2, material modifications prior to facility study, which includes an additional 15% decrease in electrical output. Do you see that?
I see that.
That's all. Thank you.
Chair Mitchell, you have one more question.
I did, but Mr. Matz answered it, so no more questions for me.
Okay, it looks like we've come to the end of the day. Thank you, Mr. Matz. We all appreciate your testimony today. Thank you. You can step down. One housekeeping matter, Mr. Snowden, I only have one Juno Matz cross.
Yes, ma'am, I was in error. We handed out two more exhibits, but I did not ask them to be identified, so I would only ask that exhibit Juno Cross Exhibit Metz 1 be into the record.
Okay, without objection.
And can I move witness Metz's two exhibits from his pre-filed testimony into the record?
Without objection. Both motions are allowed. Okay, are there any other matters? Housekeeping matters. Okay, proposed orders will be due 30 days from the receipt of the transcript. I will hold the record open for potential additional evidence and will issue an order in the future closing the record. We adjourn.